1. The first desire is the desire for freedom. When Shun woke, she was falling. Falling from nowhere to nowhere, in an infinite present. Sensations returned to her in a haphazard order. Her body was cold. She was shivering. She was thirsty. She was uncertain which way was up and which was down. Was she tied up? Beneath her feet was darkness, scattered with glints of light, and for an indeterminate moment she wondered whether she was falling into the sky. Papers fall upward in the air, half charred. No sirens and no screaming. Someone is sobbing a distance away. There are 3 loud explosions, the last one very close, and the earth buckles, and she is looking at the sky while the top of her building slides downward toward her. No. Not there. Come back. A sensation of rushing brought her the right way around. Feet toward the falling, head toward the stars. Something was pulling on her shoulders, grabbing at her waist. Jun thrashed, trying to get whatever it was off her body, and a voice in her ear said, "Warning, warning, mini-chute instability. Do not attempt to remove the chute." And she thought, "Fuck, I'm in a dream." And she thought, "What a dream." And she thought, "Shit, I'm in midair." The instinctive fingers of her right hand found the harness, checked that all 12 points were secure, felt out the raised logo in the center. Her hands were icy cold. When had that happened? What past had she come from? She searched her mind and found, for the moment, nothing. But her big brain was already making sense of the world as she perceived it. The logo shape was familiar. The leaf, the open fruit. She was wearing a Medlar safe crash jacket, advanced survival tech, not on the open market. It could detect radio signals and pilot the passenger towards civilization. She'd done this before. Drills, courses, demos. There was something important she knew she needed to remember about the Medlar safe crash jacket. Something she'd heard. Something dangerous. A cloud passed from the face of the moon, and she saw that, below her, there was an island covered in jungle. The glints of light she'd seen were the moonlight on the waves. There were sandy shores, coves, and ravines, a fire to the northeast. In the moonlight, she made out impossibly tall trees with full canopies, some scrubby open areas. Her vision flared with spots and floating patches of darkness. There was a pull on her shoulders, like a man standing behind her, steering her through a crowd. Jun turned her head instinctively. Servo motors, tilting the mini-chute south and down, toward the tree canopy. She had, for a few seconds, a full sense of the size of the island. Big, maybe the size of Tenerife, where she'd been for a vacation once. But this wasn't Tenerife. It was densely forested, and each of the large trees in the canopy was 40 or 50 feet in diameter. And beneath her and ahead of her now, a tall, flashing blue light. A beacon? A comms tower? An emergency warning? Dr. Actual Who? She tried to remember where she'd come from. Her face felt both numb and tingly, her lips sore, as if she'd been chewing them. She was floating lower. Her feet were almost touching the tree line. The parachute was going to get tangled in the tree canopy. She tried to remember the demonstrations of the Medlar safe suite. The particular danger. Was she supposed to do something? Release the harness? Contract the chute? She had a strange sense of distance. All this happening to someone else, somewhere else. There was a quiet, shrill hum behind her. She twisted her body, trying to look between her own shoulder blades. She had just enough time to panic as she saw a tiny, whirling blade severing the harness around her right shoulder. And then she was tumbling into the darkness. She plummeted. A part of her thought, "Okay, cool, I'm going to wake up." And another part thought, "No, you fucking idiot. This is real and you are too late." The fall was going to smash her bones to shards. She was going too fast. She was falling too hard. Her body was going to be impaled on a treetop or a branch or a jaguar. Nothing could save her. There was a sudden click, and all at once, she was fat and soft, her limbs puffy and pliant. She pinwheeled in place. Her neck was swaddled with rolls of squashy, comfortable material, wrapped for her own protection. Oh, that was it, she remembered. She'd been to a briefing about this. Crash jackets inflate no more than 10 meters above the earth to prevent the passenger being caught on obstructions at higher altitude. Crash jackets inflate in less than 100,000th of a second. There is no danger that the passenger will experience a deadly impact event. Yes, that was it. Somewhere far outside her, there was an impact. It felt as though she had been smacked by a stern hand through 50 down jackets. Her spine clicked a couple of times. It was quite pleasant. She could smell wet earth. She thought, okay, this isn't a dream. This is a world-class piece of equipment currently only available to certain military deployments and, by rumor, to certain billionaires. I am awake, and I don't know how I got here. Around her, the layers of material gently deflated. With a mechanical clunk, the crash jacket around her neck detached from the inflated fabric so she could sit up and look around. She was in a jungle clearing. Beneath her, the soil was soft and the leaves damp. A gleaming black millipede scuttled over the edge of the crash jacket, testing out the orange fabric with mouth parts working. For a moment, she watched the millipede. It was trying to chew the fabric of the crash jacket. Its head moved back and forth. Its mouth parts twitched, looking for purchase. It found a corner sticking up into a point. The jaws seized on this point, and as she watched, a single thread began to fray. A screen in the pendant portion of the crash jacket lit up with a gnomic statement, "Survival prototype 871 is 18 meters east." This was new. A green dot blipped on the screen. Jen tried to press the screen, but nothing happened. Survival prototype 871? To her left and to her right, the jungle was stirring. More millipedes, some twice or three times as long as the original one, their flesh moist and dark, bustled purposefully across the counterpane of her mini-chute. No. No. Absolutely no. Fuck no. Whatever the fuck this was, she wasn't going to end up eaten or poisoned or whatever the shit giant millipedes did to you. She pulled her aching, jolted muscles together, hunched herself into a crouch, and said the words her mother had said to her long ago in Hong Kong before everything worthwhile ended. Lai ba, bo bui. Come on, little girl. Come on, baby. Come on, you can do it. Stand up, darling. Stand up, Lai ba. She pushed herself upward through the soles of her feet, her shins, her hips, her pelvis. She felt as if blood was pounding through holes in her body and draining into the earth. She was up, bent half over, but up. Wearing, she noticed, the same jeans, the same socks she'd worn when she'd left Marius and gotten into the limo. But was that an hour ago? A day? A year? It felt like acres of time and knowledge had gone past since then. She started to move. Come on, slowly, slowly. It doesn't matter how slowly you go as long as you don't stop. It took between 5 minutes and an hour to follow the dot to the end of the journey, and Shun had no way of knowing how long. Time was not moving at a normal pace. She looked at her feet tramping through mud, tripping on roots and sliding in soft earth. She looked at the green dot moving forward, forward, this way, this way. At a certain point, she slipped in the mud, a long slide, her left foot careening forward, and there was sudden bright pain through the sole. She fell forward heavily onto her knees. The foot was bleeding. Something sharp in the soil had cut it. She felt with her fingers and found a long, lacerating shard of metal, something that had been sheared off an enormous machine, painted white on one side and blank steel on the other, as impossibly foreign here in this jungle as she was. She realized suddenly that the reason she could see her blood-soaked sock was that she didn't have shoes on, but she had no idea when she'd lost them. A piece of knowledge from long ago said, Shoes fall off when you're plummeting through the air. But that fall to Earth seemed so long ago it could scarcely be relevant anymore, could it? No matter, she continued, hands and knees forward doggedly. When the green dot stopped moving, she looked up. There was a 2-meter-tall, egg-shaped object made of gray-white plastic, with a blue flashing light on a pole at the top. The egg was open. Sitting inside it, like the figure of an ancient emperor on a throne within, was a large metal and polymer suit, the faceplate open, hinged upward, the torso open, the shin and thigh guards flipped open. She realized she could step right into it. It looked to have been constructed for an 8-foot-tall person weighing at least 500 pounds. It was a giant. Survival prototype 871, I presume? She spoke aloud, and the sound of her own voice, the familiarity of it here, made her laugh. And the sound of her laughter made her cry. This is a trip. Someone has drugged you, Bo-boy, said Shun. Her voice sounded like the voice of her mother when she spoke Chinese, and for a moment she felt her mother was next to her, pushing the hair from her forehead and wiping the sweat from her eyes. That her own hand was her mother's hand, and that she would be all right because there was someone with her now. She was shivering. The word prototype didn't sound convincing. But on the other hand, it looked ready. And it didn't feel plausible she'd survive long without some help. What do you think, Mama? She said to herself. Bo-boy, the first right decision is whatever keeps you alive. This is the law of the jungle, Jun thought, and then laughed because she actually was in a fucking jungle. How ridiculous! She'd never been one to trust someone else's tech, still less something that looked like it had been constructed on the pattern of Marvel's Iron Man. Something about it looked weirdly familiar and gave her a slightly gross feeling, but she couldn't place it. How had it come to be here? She looked behind her and was surprised that she could still see the remains of her inflated survival bubble. The infinite walk couldn't have been more than a few hundred yards. The folds of orange material were already teeming with insects. She looked up. The sky swarmed with stars, as the earth with life. She had nothing. No pack, no knife in her knee holster, no shoes, no phone. Even if all she could do was to shelter inside this enormous figure until dawn, she would be more likely to survive the night than if she slept on the wet earth here. The future calls us on, one painful step at a time, and the first rule of life is to survive. She walked herself backward into the suit, pulled off her sodden socks, and put her feet into the boots, wincing as the injured foot touched the yielding inner. The material was soft against the bare soles of her feet. Legs into the shin guards, thighs into the upper legs. She rested her ass against roughly where this 8-foot-tall person's ass would be. Welcome to the survival suit, said a smooth voice. Designed for survival in more than 3,000 fully researched disaster scenarios. I am the suit. I will keep you alive. In the circumstances, that was quite a promise. That was a you she wanted to be. Okay, said Shun. And, very gently, the suit began to shrink. Inner dimensions, said the suit, are being adjusted for best fit. The knee joints aligned with her knees. The trunk found her waist. It felt like a well-tailored outfit. As the front closed around her, she braced for the suit to be heavy, but she felt slightly buoyed, as if she were standing in a pool of water. It was easier to move now. A gentle bubble of warm air was extruded around her body. She stopped shivering and let out an involuntary sigh. The faceplate visor lined itself up with her actual face. A shooting star logo, she didn't recognize it, swept across her field of vision. The suit said, "You are riding in the survival suit. A fully optimized technology to allow you to thrive in this environment," a slight pause, "an island of dense tropical jungle." Another pause, longer this time. "Communication systems have been unable to contact any satellites or hubs. I will try again at intervals. All the information needed to preserve your life in dense tropical jungle is preloaded into my systems. I will begin a preliminary scan of your environment. On the visor screen in front of her, fine, glowing green lines drew themselves around various objects. The trees, the crash jacket remnants, the millipedes, other insects, plants. Next to the objects, labels floated. Canopy tree, giant kapok, strangler fig, Acanthelius blainvillii. That last label crawled along as the millipedes moved. The thought floated through her mind that the suit sounded like auger, that it must be part of the protocol. But even thinking about this right now was too much. She heard her mother's voice in her head again saying, "Baba, not now. The girl has to rest. The girl has been through a lot. The world can wait." "Would you like to tell me your name?" asked the suit. Shun hesitated. It was a principle of her life not to tell pieces of technology more about her than she had to. The suit said, "If you do not wish to give your name, I can address you solely as you. Is that preferable?" "Yes," she said. "Great, nice to meet you. Your blood solutes and vital signs show that you are dehydrated and sleep-deprived. You have several cuts and abrasions, and you may be in shock. My advice is that we find a safe place for you to sleep and some water, and that then you need a nice long nap. Do you agree?" "Yes," she said. "Great," said the suit, and it sounded as cheerful and convincing as a slick and well-trained salesman. "We're going to get through this together."